morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, December 14, and here are some of the stories we are covering. West African leaders are concerned by the slow pace of return to democracy in Mali and Guinea.
Mali president sent them a message telling them that by the end of December, they will determine their final take on the date of the election. And ECOWAS reiterated its own desire to have the election in February.
The United Nations says illegal child labor is growing after a 20-year downward trend. Cameroon says next month's African Football Cup of Nations will be successful despite separatist threats. And Gambia's opposition leader files a petition to challenge the outcome of the December 4th presidential election.
For us, we believe the elections were transparent, free and fair. The observers could attest to that, both local and international observers. So we are not the least surprised that they challenge it. It is their right.
And Benin legalizes abortion. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. West African leaders have expressed concern over what they say is the slow pace of return to constitutional rule in Mali and Guinea. In a communique following their meeting Sunday, December 12, the leaders said there was the absence of clear indicators leading to the restoration of constitutional rule in line with their demands. ECOWAS had given Mali and Guinea 6 months to hold elections following coup d'etats in both countries. Prior to Sunday's summit held in the Nigerian capital, Abuja, Mali's military leader, Colonel Assimi Goïta sent a letter to ECOWAS promising to announce a timetable for return to democratic rule by January 31st, 2022. However, the ECOWAS leader said if no concrete progress is made by the end of December 2021, ECOWAS will impose additional economic and financial sanctions beginning January 1st, 2022. Ibrahima Khan is a Senegalese political analyst.
Mali president sent them a message telling them that by the end of December, they will determine their final take on the date of the election. And ECOWAS reiterated its own desire to have the election in February. At the same time, they opened the door because they said they were going to take sanction, but they will wait to the end of the year before taking the final sanction. So meaning that they will wait for Mali to submit a kind of realistic timetable. I think that's the kind of agreement that we are seeing between Mali and the ECOWAS.
Now, the ECOWAS meeting said that if by the end of December 21, concrete progress in the preparation of the election, they will impose additional sanctions. Is that an encouraging way to go about it?
Yes, I think both Mali and ECOWAS want the crisis in Mali to end. Mali wants, because they are currently organizing meetings in the whole country to discuss the future of the democracy in Mali. This series of meetings will end in December. And probably in December, we will have now a clear idea when Mali stakeholders want to organize the election and when they are thinking that they will have a new constitution and other stuff. ECOWAS also has an interest in this because sanctioning Mali for not organizing elections will not help. Mali is on the verge of collapsing. If you take those kind of sanctions, you will even contribute to the collapse of the country.
What did they have to say about Guinea?
It's very interesting what they're saying about Guinea. Guinea, they're still waiting for a clear timetable for the transition, which has not yet been submitted by the Guinean authorities. As you know, the transition parliament has not yet been established and other stuff, and they're still negotiating with the different stakeholders a timetable. I think ECOWAS is just waiting for that timetable to be submitted then to make a decision. But I think the way they're treating Guinea indicates clearly that they really don't want to replicate the mistake they've made in Mali, so that they are discussing with them and they are trying to really find a common denominator for the smooth transition to the Guinea-Conakry.
There was a meeting, I think it's the Kofi Annan Peace and Security Forum in Ghana. It was very interesting reading. the presentation, including the Ghanaian president, Nana Akufo-Addo. The concern is the decline of what is a democracy in West Africa. What do you make of that? Were you following it?
Oh, yes, but we all know that the fact that there is a kind of resumption of coup d'etat in the region, the fact that the crisis in Mali, in Burkina Faso, in Niger, have not found solution means that democracy is in crisis. You know, in many countries, election is always a source of problems. All this indicate that in West Africa, we are facing a number of problems. So yes, the democracy is in crisis, but we need to find a solution to it. And it is really surprising because one of the reports that we thought will be examined during this ECOWAS summit was the report prepared by the chairperson of the commission on the limitation of terms. Unfortunately, there is no mention of that report in the communique, meaning that they didn't reach an agreement on the content and maybe on the recommendation of the report.
Thank you very much again for talking with us.
Thank you. Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Ibrahim Akane is a Senegalese political analyst. He was speaking with us from Dakar, Senegal. In the Gambia, leaders of the Opposition Alliance for Patriotic Reorientation and Construction, or the APRC, say they want President Adama Barrow to have a successful second term. The APRC forged a formal alliance with President Barrow ahead of the December 4th presidential election. Some reports alleged that the APRC backed the president as part of a deal to have its leaders appointed to government positions. The remarks come after opposition presidential candidate Usainu Dabo filed a petition challenging the outcome of the December 4th election. Dodu Jah is the executive secretary of the Gambian Opposition Alliance for Patriotic Reorientation and Construction. He tells viewers Peter Colotti the presidential election was free, fair, and credible.
For us, we believe the elections were transparent, free, and fair. The observers could attest to that, both local and international observers, most of whom have shared their reports and their findings through what they witnessed and experienced during voter registration, during campaigning, and during election day itself, that is the voting day. So we are not the least surprised that they challenge it. It is their right. And secondly, we're not been moved by it. We know 100% that the elections were free and fair. They're just exercising their rights and they're entitled to it.
But Mr. Dabo and two of the candidates expressed concern about delays and that party agents raised issues that the Electoral Commission did not address in the run-up to the election, which they feel undermined the transparency and integrity of the election. How do you respond to that?
Mr. Peter, I think they need to be more specific when you talk about delay. Delay in what? The Independent Electoral Commission has all the time that they need in order to make sure that results that are coming in, it will definitely be verified and approved by all the agent reps within the IC before results are announced. And it is well known, as we results come in, it starts with the smaller administrative areas going into bigger regions where you will need to tabulate from all the polling centers before you'll be able to announce results. A lot of caution was given to the IEC to avoid a repeat of 2016 elections whereby they would make errors and announce two different results. This has been reiterated over and over again. I believe the IEC were taking their time to make sure that results would be announced accordingly and to make sure errors won't be repeated as what transpired in the 2016 elections. They need to be more specific what delay they're talking about.
Duduja, since your party supported President Adama Barrow to win re-election, what are your expectations?
Expectations are not very high. In a sense, a lot of people believe we went into an agreement to get positions to make sure that we will be appointed in government. That is not our ultimate goal. We just want to see a progressive Gambia, a more developed country. taking into account that not a lot of or many positions are available in cabinet. And you don't expect the president to sack all his cabinet and employ new people in cabinet. That's not what we are looking forward to. We want to see his government succeed in serving this country, our Gambia, and delivering to its people to their basic necessities. You know, when you talk about the energy sector, education, agriculture, tourism, and the list goes on. We want to see improvement in it, and we'll continue to support him to make sure that he achieves that. But in terms of positions and what we'll occupy in government, we're not having very huge or big expectations.
So, Dudu, what role will your party play after supporting the president to win re-election? What role do you anticipate playing in the new or incoming administration if you are not seeking for positions?
Mr. Peter, we're not the only party in the alliance or the Grand Coalition. Many political parties and quite a number of independent aspirants who also supported the cause of the president. Collectively, we're looking at the greater good of the country. We must be united and we must work together closely. Our focus is in the upcoming parliamentary elections and the local government elections that will follow suit. We know being in government is one thing, but parliament has a lot of powers. And in order for government cause to be easy, they must be supported by parliament. Like I said, not many positions are available, and we're not the only political party. But we might have a few amongst those. That depends with the president. He has all the powers to appoint people to cabinet and other government positions. But collectively, our role as a party is to support his agenda, his development agenda, moving this country forward.
Dudu Jah is the executive secretary of the Gambian Opposition Alliance for Patriotic Reorientation and Construction. You're speaking with VOA's Peter Clotte from Banjul. Nigerian police on Monday detained journalist Fisayo Soyombo, founder of the Foundation for Investigative Journalism. A report in the Daily Post of Nigeria on Monday said Soyombo received a text message from the police on November 23, 2021, saying they were conducting an investigation in which his name and phone number appear. The police asked Soyombo to come to the headquarters for an interview with the Inspector General of Police. Soyombo honored the request on Monday, only to be detained. Nigerian human rights activist Omoyele Sowore says the Foundation for Investigative Journalism had written a story on the awarding of contracts for the construction of her police camps. He says activists hope to retain lawyers for journalist Fisayo Soyombo by today, Tuesday.
Fisayo is an investigative journalist, and he writes a lot of investigative reporting. I mean, he does a lot of investigative reporting on corruption in Nigeria. He was invited by the police hierarchy today that they wanted to investigate that he's not by match in one corruption story that they themselves were investigating. He arrived there, but luckily, they took his phones, and before they did, he did post something on Facebook, and I think Twitter, that they have just arrived to the police headquarters. That is the last we heard from him. But what we later found out was that he had done a report on police corruption recently, and that's apparently the reason they're after him.
What sort of police corruption that he reported on?
It's about a housing project in the police department in Nigeria, the police force. That's the reporting he did, and that what got him pissed off, to the best of my understanding.
What is the procedure? Can the police just pick him up for doing a report, or can they bring him to court?
They pick up people randomly for reporting that they claim is criminal libel, which is alien to Nigerian laws, but that's what they do. So nobody has heard from him. He's not been allowed access to his lawyers, his family, doctors, since he went in there some 7 hours ago.
So what's next? Well, I mean, did you say that you are trying to hire some lawyers?
Yes, but tomorrow we will get some human rights lawyers to visit him and find out why he's in detention.
Very interesting. Thank you so much, my brother. It's so nice to talk with you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Omoyele Sowore is a Nigerian human rights activist. He was speaking with us from the capital, Abuja. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I am James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, December 14. Benin has adopted a new law legalizing abortion in most cases, one of the few African countries to do so. A conservative country, the law was passed by parliament to prevent a wave of clandestine abortions that have resulted in deaths. Kouam Joel Honore has this report from Cotonou.
5 years ago, Francine became pregnant. A student at the time, she was afraid to tell her parents. She asked VOA not to use her real name and protect her identity.
I couldn't tell my parents because I was still in college, and if they learned of my pregnancy, I was going to stop going to school.
She ended up getting a clandestine abortion, but the procedure went badly and she had to be hospitalized.
When we got here, we were taken to the consultation room. I lay down on a table, and when I took off the filling I was wearing, things were coming out of me. They told me it was my intestines.
There has been an increase of clandestine abortions this year as sexual assault have risen, says the head gynecologist of Aplahwe City Hospital.
I had to manage 3 cases of clandestine abortions. There is one who died, and there are 2 teenagers, 17 and 18 years old, who are alive, but they no longer have their uteruses.
According to Benin's Ministry of Social Affairs, 200 women die each year as a result of complication. This led the government to introduce a law in October authorizing abortion to stop such death.
Avec le constat qui a été fait,
we really had to react. We have hundreds of women who died in deplorable conditions because they wanted to try to abort under non-secure conditions.
But Benin's clergy and traditional leaders oppose the law as an attack on life.
La vie de l'homme est quelque chose d'important.
The life of a human being is something important and must be considered. The problem is to know in what conditions the woman got pregnant.
But those who have had complications from clandestine abortions says there should be no debate about saving the life of women.
When we get pregnant and don't want to keep it, we have to be helped. Pregnancy prevents us from going to school.
Benin's government is preparing to launch a public awareness campaign in schools and throughout the country about merits of the abortion law. Kouam Joel Honore for VOA News, Cotonou, Benin.
The United Nations says an estimated 16.6 million children in sub-Saharan Africa alone are forced into illegal labor. And despite being outlawed, advocates say child labor is on the rise. Globally, 1 in 10 children are now believed to be involved in some form of child labor. In this report from southern Burkina Faso, reporter Henry Wilkins looks at why child labor is such a persistent problem.
It's cotton harvest season in Burkina Faso. In this village in the country's south, everyone in the community turns out to bring in the white gold, as it's sometimes called. Men, women and children. Wend Kuni and Wend Yam, whose names have been changed to protect their identities, are 10 and 12. They go to school, but much of the rest of the time is spent harvesting cotton. Wend Kuni says he's 10 years old. He gets up in the morning and goes to school, and when he comes back, he goes to the field to work. They have a lot of lessons at school, he says, and his favourite subjects are geography and science.
Geography.
A report by UNICEF says that a 20-year downward trend in child labour globally has come to an end in recent years, and numbers are going up again. Experts say data was collected pre-COVID-19, and they predict that the pandemic might exacerbate the situation. Wend Jam says he comes to the field to work and picks cotton. He says he comes to the fields with his father and hopes to own his own field when he is older. Wend Kuni and Wend Yam's parents cannot harvest all the cotton they grow themselves, and they say for the family to make enough money to eat, the children have to help. Child labour in Burkina Faso is illegal, but the law is difficult to enforce and families that live in poverty do not have the resources to harvest cotton without the help of the children. Benjamin Smith is a child labour specialist at the UN's International Labour Organization.
Many countries, although they've adopted good policies and laws, the ILO Convention on Worst Forms of Child Labour is universally ratified, they're facing headwinds in terms of lack of economic growth, inequality, persistent inequality, and continued, pervasive poverty.
Experts say cotton produced with child labour makes it into the international supply chain easily and can be found at all levels of the fashion industry. However, advocates say while this is difficult to stop, it is possible. Gine Zwart is a programme officer at ERISA, a human rights non-profit advocating for global rights. Zwart says brands need to ask questions about the origins of cotton.
One thing is for brands, definitely, is transparency and knowing where their cotton comes from. Because if you don't know, if you have no clue where your cotton comes from, you also have no clue, whether there's child labour or not, and you can't research that.
Zwart says it's also important for consumers to ask questions. Wend Cooney, meanwhile, says he wants to focus on his education. He says he loves school, and when he grows up, he hopes to be a teacher. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Southern Burkina Faso.
Cameroon authorities have vowed a safe African Football Cup of Nations when they host the biannual tournament in January. Cameroon's Anglophone separatists have threatened further attacks on two towns that have stadiums to be used for group matches. Moki Edwin Kizeka reports from Yaoundé.
Cameroon's police, military and senior government officials have been holding meetings to ensure a successful African Football Cup of Nations, AFCON, which runs from January 9 to February 6. On Thursday, Cameroon assembled its 10 regional governors in the capital to examine the country's readiness to host 24 African soccer teams, officials, and thousands of fans expected for the tournaments. Paul Atanganji is Cameroon's territorial administration minister and permanent secretary of its National Security Council. He says President Paul Biya ordered the meeting to make sure Cameroon gives Africa and the world the most successful AFCON the continent has ever seen. Nji says Biya does not want the games to be disrupted by separatists and politicians whom he accused of wanting to project a bad image of Cameroon to the outside world.
We have told politicians that Cameroonians want a peaceful country. Politicians should be reasonable. All Cameroonians should be ambassadors behind our great leader, President Paul Biya, to make this AFCON a great event. Any attempt to disrupt public order will be dealt with squarely. I'm very clear, the regional governors have taken up the challenge to promote peace, unity, tranquility, living together during the AFCON.
Nji specifically accused opposition leader Maurice Kamto, who still insists he won the 2018 presidential elections, of planning to disrupt the games. But Kamto says he will be educating civilians on the need for Cameroon to revise its electoral code, which he says favors Biya during the AFCON matches. Meanwhile, separatist groups on social media platforms have issued warnings that AFCON matches should not be played in Limbe and Boya, two towns in the southwest region. Langmi Nestor is spokesperson of the separatist Ambazonian National Self-Defense Council. He says fighters have been instructed to disrupt the games if Biya does not withdraw its troops fighting separatists in the English-speaking western regions. This week, defense officials said extra troops have been deployed to protect soccer fans and players all over Cameroon and vowed the matches in Limbe and Boya would go on. The military says it has deployed troops to the border between French-speaking and English-speaking regions to stop rebels from advancing during AFCON. Mokki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
And that's it for this Tuesday, December 14th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte.